Hello and welcome to the Games with Garfield podcast. I'm your host, Tyler Bielman. I'm alongside the irreparable Richard Garfield.
Hello.
And the inevitable Skizaf Elias.
Yep.
And we are here to talk to you today about a concept in games that is very important, especially in persistent games like the ones we design, which is the idea of game balance. But before we dive into this meaty topic, I did want to take a second and thank everybody who posted comments on the website. We really appreciate the comments on the blog entries and on the radio show. So you can get there at www.gameswithgarfield.com. That URL again is www.gameswithgarfield.com, and it'll take you right there. And if you listen to the show, even if you want to just drop a comment that says, hey, I liked this or I didn't like that, quick comments are welcome. We always appreciate it. We don't get a lot of positive feedback here in the cave, do we, guys?
Certainly not from each other.
No.
So we'd love to hear from you. And Richard also does great blog entries there as well. You did one about handicapping and handicaps in games not that long ago.
That's right.
Thought it was great. Got a lot of action on that. A lot of good comments on that as well. So, again,
I think the proper term is gameplay challenged.
No, and you don't have to say that. You don't have to. It's okay.
Oh, okay.
And that URL again is www.gameswithgarfield.com. So in the comments on our podcast about nerfing, a user named Amasir, I'm sorry if I'm pronouncing that wrong. It's Amasir, had a really thoughtful, interesting comment about...
You should learn how to pronounce it since he's made a lot of good posts.
He has. He's a great frequenter of the blog site at www.gameswithgarfield.com. And so anyway, he makes an interesting point. In our conversation about nerfing, we did mention that the idea of balance or of perfect balance is something that comes up a lot in what we do. And the idea of when we talked about nerfing and power level, we spoke about how it's not really the absolute power level in the system. It's how people play the game that has a lot more to do with making a choice to change things like nerfing. So his comment was, in a sufficiently complex system with a large enough user base over time, eventually the core stats will come through. And that the actual power level, the stuff you'd find in the spreadsheets, really does make a huge difference. Because with enough monkeys at enough typewriters, you're going to get the math out of it eventually. Mixing metaphors there, but that's okay. So he makes the point that to a new player who has the ability to make suboptimal choices if the system is unbalanced, that player's not going to have a great experience out of the gate because they're going to be perceived by the other users in the environment as being new or making dumb decisions, or as he said, I picked a dragon even though they suck. So, we in the nerfing podcast, we touched on balance, but I think it's a big enough topic. And I found in my experience when I work with different clients or different companies that a lot of them who know enough to be dangerous kind of say, well, I need you to do the balancing. The balancing is the hard part, the math part that nobody understands, the black box. And so let's talk a little bit about what balance means and talk a little bit about the historical context. So we've talked in this podcast about historical war simulations and miniatures games. Skaff, this is something you grew up on. These are simulations. They're not necessarily intended to be games in the sense that there's a lot of modification to historical.
Well, no, that's not true. They're the ones that get picked, the battles that get picked are the ones that, are balanced. The time periods that get picked are the ones that are balanced. I mean, they are intended to be games. They wouldn't be played if they were just purely historical simulations and you're picking random battles, 90% of which are predetermined. I mean, so the stuff that gets filtered through happens to be a combination of simulation with good gameplay. That's what people end up playing.
And sometimes the balance is also not from the point of view of the battle, but what you're trying to do. Maybe you're not trying. It's not a matter of who wins, but how long you hold on or
right. Exactly. When you get these overarching consistent historical simulations, especially of a campaign where there's many battles which are predetermined, the victory conditions are set such that they are balanced.
So there's a lot. Were there a lot of asymmetrical victory conditions? And put it into modern parlance, are they all death matches, or would you, as the North, have a different victory condition than me as the South?
I think it's probably almost the most common, especially in the more accurate historical situations, the most common thing is asymmetric victory conditions.
And so you're saying that if you look at all the battles through history, the ones that make the best historical simulation games are those that are sort of inherently balanced or could be adapted to give you this balance. So that's what becomes popular.
Obviously some time periods are more popular than others. Napoleonics or Civil War, there's a lot of, or World War II, there's certain time periods that people just want to play. So if the battle or the situation isn't inherently balanced, then you come up with a set of victory conditions where the gameplay is fun. You can always make the gameplay fun by coming up with asymmetric victory conditions. Well, often can make the gameplay fun by coming up with asymmetric victory conditions.
So then we're talking to, so we go from historical miniatures games into the board game era. Richard, you're the resident board game expert. Were there ever issues of balance in board games that you felt like had to be adjusted or changed?
Sure. Well, balance is a constant topic in hobby games, in just about anything. I think the main thing is to ask yourself is what you're striving for with the balance. Like if a particular strategy always wins, then that could be something that's bad because everybody plays the same way, or it could be something that's okay. You just it's what grade of that strategy are you going to play?
Yeah, and it's you almost have to define balance first before we start.
Let's do that.
Going much further. One way that we tend to think of it is exactly what Richard just said. To sort of broaden it a little bit, is you've got multiple strategies and or tactics. And people tend to think of things becoming unbalanced if you're given a fairly wide array and you're not able to choose from them. It collapses down to one particular strategy or tactic or character class or set of cards or deck or whatever that always dominates, and it's the one you should play. Now, maybe it's not just one. Maybe it's 2 out of 10 that you're offered or whatever. There's a little bit of a sort of subjectivity that comes into exactly when you say something is unbalanced, but in general it's that issue of some sort of collapse of your options that you would prefer not to have.
And that's going to be different for different designers and different players, what they think should be collapsed and what shouldn't. A really common example is for StarCraft and other real-time strategy games, there's a natural rock, paper, scissors embedded in it that if you can attack quickly and rush, and or you could go defensive and then you'll beat the rush, or you could go economic and try to build up a huge army and then you'll beat the person who goes defensively. So that's that makes a strategic triumvirate which you can play. But a lot of people don't like that. A lot of people just say no rushing in the first 5 minutes. You just have to build up because they want to go to a different stage of the game. And so from one player's perspective, they may be collapsing that rushing strategy out of it. They're getting rid of it. They're making it illegal, in fact. But they're getting to a different strategic area that they're interested in.
So before we dip too heavily into the rock, paper, scissors thing, just let me throw a couple of examples out. In chess, both players have the same side. They have the same access to the same pieces. One player does go first. But I think what people would argue that that's a balanced game system. And there are lots of opening strategies and counter strategies, but that there's nothing unbalanced about chess. Is that...
Well, if you're going to use the chess analogy, what you talk about chess, then people would consider chess certainly balanced for the most part. But oftentimes when people are talking about balance, they're talking about, is the queen balanced in chess? And of course, both people have a queen, so it is balanced. But on the other hand, if the entire game, like if when I move my queen, I kill all the other pieces, then the game's kind of unbalanced, right? Boom, I move the queen, all the other pieces are gone. People would perceive that as a strategic collapse they're not interested in.
And the other thing, too, would be tactically, how balanced is it tactically? Or do you play this one opening and this one defense for that opening. And of course, in chess, you don't have to.
Right. And so. we've all seen variations on chess or games similar, where now each piece has a cost associated with it. And I can build an army of a disproportionate number of pawns because they're cheaper, and then I can afford a couple more on the high-end expensive pieces. And this is where balance starts to become, I think, where most people think of it, where there's a cost for something and what you get for it. Is that fair to sort of say that takes us into the realm of more these game systems where there's an economic pattern?
No, it's really broad. I mean, a lot of times it is tactics. There used to be a game called Tribes. It was a first-person shooter on the computer, and you know, it was pretty fun.
Had the jet packs, right? Is what I remember from Tribes.
Yeah.
You jump jets. I loved the jump.
And then it turned out after a while that people would get really good at this thing called jump disking, where you would jump up in the air and you'd shoot your most basic weapon, your pistol, so to speak, for that system, and you'd shoot it right at the person's feet as they landed. And if you got good enough at that, it kind of dominated all of the other weapons. So you're not talking about cost. You're not talking about choice. You're talking about something tactically that is out of balance, where
there's a dynamic.
Right. So it's really a very general discussion. You know, and I think they did patches to fix that later. But the point is, at some point, it was dominant. And that would be more the equivalent in chess if chess were unbalanced. You know, sort of a priori, you sit down to a two-person turn-based strategy game like chess, and you don't know if it's balanced or not. Chess has turned out to be, but it could have been and that there was a dominant strategy, or that white always won, et cetera, et cetera. In fact, I think if you create a game randomly yourself with pieces somewhat chess-like and lay them down on a board, you more likely than not, you'll run into a situation where there is some unbalancing factor. So it's not really just about cost. Mm-hmm.
You are right, though, that is worth bringing up as a specific area people are interested in. When people are building their own armies or decks or things like that, then they naturally become more interested in balance in a different way. It's a related way, but it hits them in the pocketbook, or it really affects the game in a much more personal level.
It is really critical when you're paying for those objects with real money, or if you're paying for them in time, like you to build up a 60th level character in World of Warcraft. You don't want to put in the 10,000 hours, and then it's probably less than that. And
you can go to 80th now, so you're a little behind.
80th, sorry, yeah. And then find out, wow, you know, your guy just isn't the best guy. No one wants to take you around.
Get it? Wow.
Wow, yeah, I got that.
So just to kind of take it back for a second, so then you take a game like Monopoly, an economic game, you know, you have people that will do the slumlord strategy, where they'll hold on to their money but buy up the cheap properties. Then you have the people that really want Boardwalk and Park Place. These people can trade properties so they can get into the strategy that they want sometimes. Are there balance issues in a game like Monopoly?
There probably are, but again, they're lessened because let's say you play a game of Monopoly and you find out that this isn't the case, but let's say you find out that you just win, you know, much more higher chance of winning if you have Boardwalk and Park Place than the Slumlord strategy. Well, you haven't put that much time into it pursuing the Slumlord path, so the next game, you can try, you know, the different path. You haven't lost a bunch of hours or a bunch of money. So are there balance issues? Yes. Are they nearly as important as in these other types of games? No.
Yeah, there's a couple things which make it less important also. Warcraft, the real-time strategy game, Warcraft 2, say, if there's a strategy which people perceive as being dominant, then there's going to be a tendency for them to pursue that strategy. And then, of course, that strategy will win more often. And so you get this positive feedback. The strategy that wins the most is the ones that people use the most. And in particular, the best players, the people who believe it's the best strategy, are going to win that way.
And then there's also the people that are going to talk about it more. And so it becomes this self-fulfilling prophecy.
Right. And right. So when you're playing a game like Monopoly, if it's perceived that the best way to win is to get Boardwalk and Park Place, then I play a game and I end up with it and I win and I end up with it and I end up with those two properties and I win and I end up with those two properties and I don't win. It's like other people have to pursue a different strategy. There's no, you know, or quit the game. All right. If they the balance is a problem if they perceive it so bad that it's not worth playing anymore. But as long as they perceive it's worth playing, then they're going to be forced to try these other things. And so that kind of breaks the positive feedback loop.
So before, in sort of the pre-Magic era of tabletop games, there, you know, Magic introduces this metagame, this secondary market, this idea that you're building your own decks, and that you have to make, you're making these choices, and you're playing with a subset of the game items. Magic also has each card has a cost, or a lot of the cards have a cost, which I think, again, allows people access to the idea of balance more easily. What did you find when you were putting Magic together in terms of balance and in terms of how to figure out what was going on in that system? And did you believe there was imbalance? Do you believe do you now, looking back, believe there was imbalance? And what did you think about that, the issues of balance as a product and not just a game?
Well, our attitudes on balance evolved over time. Certainly at the beginning, we knew that there were broken cards, broken decks, but we thought that that it was going to be controlled by people's buying patterns, that people just weren't going to have that many cards. And so if you've got one Black Lotus in a deck, it's not going to dominate the play. But as people showed more of an appetite, they liked the game so much, and it became a hobby and not just a game they played every once in a while. Then that became a real issue, and we had to learn how to balance the system as a whole a lot better.
Especially, I mean, from my perspective, when I first started playing it, and Richard was first creating the cards, he was. Semi-conscious, but you know, automatically intuitive level. He had built in all these negative feedback loops into the system, and this is sort of the key. This is the secret to, if you want to make a balanced system. You know, you talked about rock, paper, scissors before. That's really the core of a system which you know is going to be inherently balanced. So what Richard did is he was very adamant on, okay, well, we need things like Shatterstorm and Conversion and all these sorts of different cards which hosed particular strategies. If red was too good, then there would be a way to stop it. If artifacts were too good, there would be a way to stop it. And in addition to that, there was an overall rock, paper, scissors of, you know, various strategies beating each other, much like in StarCraft. And what happens when you do those sorts of things is that it's actually very hard for the system to get out of balance. Its natural state wants to be in balance. I think in the long run, using like single cards to do that turned out to be not necessarily the most robust way, but the underlying idea of that is really the key to making all these systems balanced. So as an example, in all these war games, you know, you've got over history, you've got this rock, paper, scissors. You could play the old computer game Ancient Art of War, or any of the miniatures games where you have, say, fast units like cavalry beating the missile units, and the missile units beating the armored units, and the armored units beating the cavalry. And there's a lot of historical simulation involved in that did tend to happen in the real world. And then, of course, you cart it over to the game, and you've got a system that more or less is hard to get thrown out of balance.
Even though there's no unit that says destroy all planes in that system, no safeguard. We've talked about those cards as being safeguards, and you know what I find particularly compelling is that your initial concept of the balance didn't have anything to do with the game itself. It had to do with the purchasing patterns of it as a product.
No, but Scaff is right. That was my overall attitude, was it was difficult to that. It wasn't going to be a problem as long as people didn't buy too many cards. But it was the system. One of the ways that we went around balancing it was thinking about what strategies people would take and make cards that would break that strategy.
When I was exposed to those cards, I was always thinking, okay, this is just to keep you from playing mono red because this will kill all my mountains. So that's to make me be in at least two colors. That's the way that when I saw those cards for the first time, that's what I thought.
Sure, but it's not. It's more, you know. It's just, or have too much red, or have too many artifacts, you know, for things like.
Yeah, I see now that there's a governor,
right?
But it's not binary.
And there's also some more subtle ones than that, like something like Counterspell or Terror is also in some ways a balance card. If there's creatures that cost a lot, you can get rid of them. You know, if creatures are dominating the game, you can get rid of them.
Yeah, and it's Wrath of God. One thing about the robustness of rock, paper, scissors, and this deals more directly with the comment about, oh, dragons suck. If you have a rock, paper, scissors system, and let's say you go ahead and you accidentally make scissors too good. So it's exactly rock, paper, scissors, but scissors has this little rider on it, which is 20% of the time that rock would beat it, it beats rock instead. Well, my gosh! Well, scissors is now the best one. You know, paper and rock are the same as they always were.
You must throw scissors every time, right?
Yeah, and when everyone's always throwing scissors every time,
guess what?
Yeah,
rock staff comes along and rocks you, and then you don't know what to do.
Yeah, and you might win 20% of the time, but that's not as good as you want because you want to be more balanced. So what happens is you can have better and worse things. And let's say in this analogy, rocks are the dragons of the comet. It is now the worst. It is now the worst thing to pull. And instead of the unbeatable strategy of randomly choosing things a third of the time, each one of them, you're probably going to have to choose rock a little bit less and scissors a little bit more. And you can work out what the new balance number should be. But the point is that they're not zero. And the little kid who keeps playing his rock dragons, eventually, when enough people are choosing scissors, he's going to come back into the place where he's making a good decision again.
As long as all your components can be put together in such a way that they have all your components have some weaknesses and all your components have some strengths, and they're arranged in some sort of big loop, then there's a lot of robustness to the system.
Now, is everything going to work out that way? No, because maybe you created a rock, which is, you know, rock loses 99% of the time, no matter what else is chosen, and there's so many other choices that it ends up being an actually bad choice. But if you think about that loop, it does make it very difficult to be hard to get out of balance.
And in conversations I've had with game designers of varying seniority, there's this idea that there needs to be this algorithm at the end of the day where the net is zero and everything is in perfect balance. And it's my belief, predicated on a lot on work with you, that isn't necessarily the best case for a game to be in.
Sure. I mean, if it were true that you could balance everything so that everything was the same, and I don't think it is true, but let's say it were, then that would be pretty boring because then any combination of things you pick is fine. So that's certainly not what you want. You know, in a way, that's even worse than being slightly out of balance.
Because your choices don't have any sort of meaning at that point.
Right.
There's no bad choice, there's no good choice.
Right. And the fundamental point is with the rock, paper, scissors analogy and the scissors beating the rock dragon, some extra percentage of the time, the fundamental point there is there's no way to balance. There's no way to figure out, you know, make those things equal. Scissors is better than rock, but it depends on the player environment. If a lot of people are playing scissors, then all of a sudden rock becomes better. So you need to factor in what people are playing into your spreadsheet of balance, in which a lot of people don't do. They think it's balanceable in the abstract, when of course it's not. So even flavor things like, wow, you know, that the miniature of the giant robot with the rockets on it, that's just cooler than the other miniature. So a little bit of extra people are going to play that. Well, that changes the balance numbers of everything else in the whole system. So again, you can't ask for things to be balanced, you know, in the abstract on a spreadsheet ahead of time without knowing all of these things that go into what actually makes up what percentage of the time people are playing what strategy. And one extra thing is you it still leaves a lot of room for skill because the system's sufficiently complex enough that your better players are going to be the ones that adapt to the constantly changing environment faster. So they're going to accumulate their wins, and then the environment's going to rebalance to a different position. Then they're going to accumulate more wins as they keep figuring out what the proper the best play until the system comes back into balance is.
And, I mean, you sort of talk about this dynamic environment. A lot of persistent games will release new expansions to them, whether they be, a new expansion for World of Warcraft or a new expansion for a collectible card game, where they intentionally disrupt the balance, and they shift the game fairly radically in one direction in order to create that dynamic system that keeps people involved in analyzing what's going on.
Yeah, that's a pretty exciting thing that can be done these days with computer and with cards that expand in that way. As long as you have a good understanding of your system, and changing the strategy from release to release can keep the game very dynamic.
So yeah, exactly what Rich was saying. In some ideas, the ideal system with these modern games that are able to adjust their rules and card sets is one where you have this negative feedback loop, this underlying rock, paper, scissors system. And rock, paper, scissors is relatively boring for people to play because, you know, now most people, it's pretty easy to figure out that there's a strategy that can't be dominated, if you're choosing each one a third of the time. You alter that a little bit in a complex system, and it takes a couple months or, 4 months or a year or 6 months, whatever it is, until people kind of figure out roughly where the balance is, and then you hit them with the next set. Then it takes a while for people to figure it out. So there's always something for these strategy jocks to be doing. And then just as things start to settle down, you give them a new little nugget to chew on.
Right. It takes a while for players to... It takes a while for players to be able to coalesce what the strategies are, what the relevant strategies are in a new set, and so every time you disrupt the system, people have to start over. What it really becomes down to is, like, if they're playing rock, paper, scissors, it's not that interesting. But it takes them a little while to figure out what the rock, paper, scissors is. For instance, with Warcraft. The real-time strategy game, I remember when we realized there was this rock, paper, scissors between rushing the other person and going economic and going defensive. Until we did that, understood that, we didn't have any real words for that. We understood what it was to do these different strategies, but once that clicked in is this beats that, that beats that, that beats that, the game settled down into this much simpler, it was still fun, but it was much more understood system of rock, paper, scissors. Now, if the defensive units have been mixed up, or there was something that was added to the attacking units after we understood that, then we might not understand exactly what the rock, paper, scissors was in the new game.
Yeah.
And that's fun to explore.
Yeah. I've found when designing new games, right, that you creating factions or colors or, these embedded natural groupings that do certain things and have certain strengths, certain weaknesses, not only do you get this nice... this wheel, but you also give someone a place to start and to make some naturally intuitive choices that allow them to play differently, but don't allow them to fall too far behind. And I think that there's a value in that as well, in thinking of these games not as statistical, not economic or statistical or granular to a point level, but instead in these larger chunks of like grouped items that create a wheel.
I think that's a really good tool. The factions or the colors and magic of giving players a place to start, and also being a great place to embed strengths and weaknesses for a particular strategy, because red in Magic is a strategy.
Right.
So one other thing that when we talk about strategic collapse, if you do have it so that one deck in Magic dominates, that's a bad thing. Everybody plays that deck, and you either have to ban or come out with a new card set, which mixes thing up. So when is the system at its healthiest is a question which has come up a bunch. This goes back to this point Scaff made: if everything's balanced, that's not a good thing. If there's too many decks, that's not a good environment either. I don't know what the ideal number of decks in Magic is, but if you've got 20 viable decks in the top, that's probably too many. You just don't have a place to start. It's too hard to react strategically. If you've got only one, that's terrible, and two is probably bad, and three starts to become a little more interesting. But where the ideal is sometimes hard to.
And I think it also varies by where you're playing or who you're playing with. I think the local game store, the correct number of decks is different than it might be at the highest level of professional play. Scaff, you're sort of the progenitor of the professional tour for Magic and the really robust org play systems. What do you think in terms of that, what that looks like?
Well, I think that the number of decks that's viable at the, I don't want to say tournament level, certainly not the Pro Tour level, but, you know, at the Friday Night Magic level, or, you know, is a lot different depending upon, you know, where you're coming from in the audience. I think consistently the players on the Pro Tour want there to be more variety, I would say, than and maybe this is counterintuitive, but more variety than the common player does. And part of the reason is Magic's a really hard game. And if you're a common player, you really would like there to be a relatively simple deck to play that you know is going to be good. And that's pretty hard to do. And if you get to that point, most likely there's going to be, you know, that's going to be a dominant deck. There's going to be only a few dominant decks in the top of the environment. And so it's a hard question to answer. I would say, you know, one or two really good decks is kind of where you want the system to be. And then three or four decks after that are pretty good, maybe harder to play. And then, you know, a sprinkling of things here or there, which can take people by surprise. I mean, I think that's sort of where you want the environment.
So dragging this back to the actual game units themselves, whether they be cards or monsters or what have you, there are these stats that are, you know, power or toughness or shields or armor or attack value. And sometimes there's costs. And I think it's easier for people to think about balance when we talk about costs. Do you believe that all of those things should be weighed out and costed, you know, so they are all equivalent, so that there is a master number at the end? Or do you think that level of detail is problematic, because then it does lead to this idea of not having suboptimal choices?
Well, I really think that going back to re-hit it one more time, if you have sufficient amount of negative feedback loops in there, then you're fine. You know,
the one thing that I just want to make sure we cover is the math aspect, because I think when a lot of game designers think about balance and they talk about costs and this, there's a lot of economic play pattern in there. And I think in an ideal world, a lot of people would believe that their games are perfectly balanced if all the math at the end of the day, the equations are all perfectly lined up and everything adds up to zero at the end and it's all, you know, tight.
Yeah, and I hate to belabor the point, but to deal with it sort of more precisely is this idea of when you do the math, getting the numbers balanced correctly in the same ballpark is good, but it's not critical. The critical thing is, if you're going to have something that the math says, hey, this is the best, it's critical that you have some sort of negative feedback loop in there where if it is a little bit better than everything else, at the end of the day, it's still just part of the environment instead of dominating it. So that's sort of the two-part trick. Get things roughly in balance. Don't sweat that things are exactly in balance, but do sweat that you have a consistent set of negative feedback loops in the system.
So if you have a limited amount of cycles to put into your game system that you're designing, it's less important to make sure that the math is all perfect than it is to play test it, see how people are going to react to it, and figure out how to make the chunks in the system all, you know, into some kind of a wheel with strengths and weaknesses. Is that fair?
Yeah, that's true. A couple techniques which I've used successfully are one is to make sure is to try to make sure that cards or units, elements don't dominate one another. On a card by card level, that's usually pretty easy to do, where you line up one card and another card, and if this one's cheaper and better in every way, then that's a domination, right? But if this one if they cost the same and this one's regarded by people as being better, but it's not better in every way, it's a little less tough. Everybody understands that a little less tough means that it isn't as important. That's a really good thing to have in your system, where you try to make it so that that cards don't dominate one another, that elements don't dominate one another.
Strictly better is the phrase that we would always bandy about. This is strictly better. If you look at it apples to apples in every way, this unit is just inferior to the one that is strictly better.
Right, and even if this will lead to cards which in fact are better than one another, but that strictly better helps a lot, just to keep things in line. And the other thing is sort of the precedent system of design, where you have cards, usually vanilla cards, or units, usually vanilla units, which are under, which are established, set down at the right point. These are defined as being of this price. Then you just then you can build on that by when you come up with a new card or units, you talk about the abilities of it, and you find its closest comparison, and you price it relative to that. And usually your pricing system is granular enough. It's not going to be exactly balanced because you would need fractions of mana costs or something. But you price it based on where it fits relative to cards which have precedence, which begin out vanilla, but then as you understand your system better, you can get non-vanilla cards which you believe are at the right place, and you make sure that the new cards you introduce don't dominate those cards and aren't strictly worse than those cards.
And I guess a final closing point to put the final nail in the coffin of the spreadsheet balancing all the numbers correctly is that you're not in control of that. You can't decide that because you don't know what your audience is going to end up playing. And if a lot of your audience makes a mistake, obviously you've got some players better than others. If some of the worst players decide to, what strategy are they going to happen to pick? And again, it could be because the mini looks great or whatever, or the art looks good on a card. When they pick that, that changes the actual real value of the other cards, the other decks, the other strategies. So since you can't be in control of it, really don't try to be.
Although, Amir Sir, he made a point in his post, which was that he was asking about whether you should attempt to balance things for the new player, basically, because the new player coming in is going to have a feel bad moment when they realize they've been playing like a schmuck.
And I think his other point is that there are sufficiently enough players with enough interactions that the embedded math is going to come to the surface, and that this idea that you're saying is that the real value is in how people play. His argument is there's enough experimentation happening that they will figure out what is actually happening on the math side.
What are they going to figure out? Like, if they figure out the super scissors is the best one, then that means the percentages, then everyone's winning just as much, and the percentages are, you know, whatever, 60, 20, 20.
Right.
So that's not a bad situation. You just need to make sure that nothing gets so bad that it never achieves its point in the system.
Yeah, I actually don't. As far as balancing for the new player, though, I do think that there should be some level of balance for the new player. There's an ongoing argument in Magic whether you want to have bad cards for them. And one school of thought says you should have cards that everybody knows are bad, because that means that even the worst player you have will recognize this is a bad card and feel good about not playing with it.
And sign me up for believing that.
Yep, yeah.
But some level of balance I still believe is useful, in that I remember playing an old version of probably Dungeons and Dragons second edition, talking about balancing the equipment in that, and it really irritated me that there was weaponry that was strictly worse in every way than other weaponry, and it was because it meant that I couldn't, like, my role-playing had this built-in, role-playing always has a cost built into it, but here you're just being completely screwed, because if you're going to role-play and you want the scimitar, you're just having that -1 added in. And so it seemed like balancing there is something, like, there's no reason to have that unbalanced for the player.
Yeah, and part of the new player balance is, what you don't want is a system where all of the good things are hard to play. That would be pretty bad.
You mean all the difficult to play, or do you mean
difficult to play? All of the good strategies are really difficult to play. That's one thing you really want to do for the weaker player, right, or the newer player, I should say, not yeah. weaker players. You really would like there to be some good things that are also simple to play.
So, yeah. Well, that's a we've sort of I think we just started scratching the surface on balance. There's a lot of other things we could talk about. I hope that for anybody listening, especially Amasir, who had a great comment that's kind of got this whole thing rolling, and anybody else should, again, leave your comments at www.gameswithgarfield.com. And on behalf of Richard Garfield.
So long.
And Scaff Elias.
Bye-bye.
We will talk to you next time.
Hee-haw.